Okay, so we're ready to begin to our study of Ezra chapter 8 this morning. This is a chapter that at the outset, the first 14 verses have a lot of names in it, as we're going to, very similar to Ezra chapter 2. These are Ezra chapter 2. There's similarities for sure, as it's giving us an account of the ones who returned from Babylon to the land of Israel. But what is the primary difference? Well, Ezra chapter 2 was giving a breakdown by the families from the towns and villages of Judea, where the people from Judah, where the people were returning, where their families came from that were returning. But chapter 2 was giving a list of those who returned with whom? Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest. Those were the first captives that returned from Babylon. Chapter 8 is giving us details of the ones who returned with whom? Ezra the priest. These are two different groups at different times. Obviously, chapter 2 is a description of the very first captives that returned. But it's not like that was it, and no others ever went back from Babylon. So here's another major group of captives returning to the land of Israel. This is in the reign of Artaxerxes, whereas the first group was in the reign of Cyrus in his first year when he gave that decree for them to return and rebuild the temple. So as we saw details of the returnees in chapter 2, we have the details of this group that returned with Ezra. Ezra being a priest of the Lord who is going back with the primary job, mission, to establish the teaching of God's word to ensure that it would be taught throughout the land of Israel, that the captives that have returned would have the continual reminder to be able to hear God's word, to encourage them in following that so that they wouldn't depart from the Lord like their fathers had done before them, which is why they ended up in captivity in the first place, that surviving remnant. We begin chapter 8 now looking at this list, verses 1 through 14, of the ones who returned from Babylon to the land of Israel with Ezra the priest. It says, these are now the chief of their fathers, and this is the genealogy of them that went up with me from Babylon in the reign of Artaxerxes the king. So it's very clear which group he's talking about now. Verse 2, of the sons of Phinehas, Gershom, of the sons of Ithamar, Daniel, and of the sons of David, Hattush, of the sons of Shechaniah, of the sons of Pharosh, Zechariah, and with him were reckoned by genealogy of the males 150, of the sons of Pahath Moab. Let's see, I have a little smudge there on my Bible right here. Let's see. Okay, this is kicked back to chapter 7. Sorry about that. Of the sons of Pahath Moab, Elihonai, the son of Zerahiah, and with him 200 males. Of the sons of Shechaniah, the son of Jehaziel, and with him 300 males. Of the sons also of Aden, Ebed, the son of Jonathan, and with him 50 males. And of the sons of Elam, Jeshiah, the son of Athaliah, with him 70 males. And of the sons of Shephatiah, Zebediah, the son of Michael, and with him 80 males. Of the sons of Joab, Obadiah, the son of Jehiel, and with him 218 males. And of the sons of Shalomith, the son of Josaphiah, and with him 103 males. And of the sons of Bebai, Zechariah, the son of Bebai, with him 28 males. And of the sons of Azgad, Johanan, the son of Hakatan, with him 110 males. And of the last sons of Adonikim, whose names are these, Eliphelet, Jael, and Shemaiah, and with them 80 males. Of the sons also of Bigvai, Uthai, and Zabad, with them, and with them 70 males. Now, as when we read all those, which there was a lot more in chapter 2, and at that time I said we were doing that that was a one-shot deal, and so it is with those verses right there. So I hope no one is offended by the pronunciation that I gave of those names, so I apologize if any of that sounded awful, but that was my best effort at that. But anyway, that's the breakdown of the families that went back with Ezra. Now, as we also considered as a point when we were reading through chapter 2, when he was giving all of the details of the captives that the families that returned with Zerubbabel, with the first captives that came back to Israel, question being, why does the Lord tell us all these names? And there were right at 50,000 that were in the group that went back with Zerubbabel in Ezra 2. So, I mean, obviously, the Lord could have said, given the number, and said that this many captives went back at that time. He could have told us a number here, condensed it down to one verse if he had so desired. Obviously, that was not God's desire. And he desired instead to give us more details of these different families, question why. One of the things that we considered as a possible answer to that question, as we see in other cases, the Lord will, those who did not do his will, and this is something that we see very plainly at the end of the book of Nehemiah, when he rebuilt the walls of the city, and the ones that broke God's commandment intermarried with the nations that surrounded them, those ones that the Lord had forbidden them to marry, that he had forbidden them from doing so, they broke that commandment, and then the Lord gave a list of the ones who had broken his commandment. And so sometimes the Lord gives us names and details of ones who did evil. What is an obvious point of that? I mean, that would be to their shame, but the Lord lets us know about those different ones so we can learn, okay, here's what we must not do. When the Lord takes the time to go through all the details and lets us know these different families who went back from Babylon to the land of Israel, well, this is the opposite, isn't it? I mean, these are ones that fulfilled God's will. I mean, it was his will for his people to return to the land. Those first ones rebuilt the temple, but now here are many others that are ready to go back there. The ones that stayed in Babylon, especially now that the temple has been rebuilt, are there any commandments of God that Israelites that are in Babylon would not be able to obey, that Israelites that were in the land of Israel could? Was there any difference in where they were? There was. Three times a year, what did God command his people to do at the very specified times? They had three feast days in the year, the Passover, the Feast of Weeks, also known as Pentecost, and there was the Feast of Tabernacles. They had those three feasts during the year where all the males of the children of Israel were commanded to go to the place that God had designated, and originally that was Shiloh, where the tabernacle was. But then after the temple, Solomon's temple, was built, it was in Jerusalem where they were to go. And that remains the place. But when there was no temple, those commandments couldn't be obeyed. now that the temple was rebuilt. And that was one reason why it was so important and why the Lord honored the ones who left Babylon to make that journey back to Israel to rebuild the temple. It was so important to do that so that those commands could be obeyed. The daily sacrifices and all of those things as well. But the Israelites that were in Babylon, were they going to make the trip from there all the way to Israel three times a year? They weren't. So did it matter where they were? It did. Were they going to be able to do more of the will of God if they were in the land of Israel? And unquestionably, the answer would be yes. The ones that had that heart that, in this case, and we'll mention it again because now some more years have passed. So one of the points that we made when we were studying chapter 2 with those Israelites that first went back with Zerubbabel, this was 70 years after the captives first went over. How many of that number were of those original returnees had been in Israel where they had remembered it and then returned? I mean, there was some, because when they saw the foundation of the second temple laid, they remembered the first. So there were some that would have put them in the age range of somewhere 80 or above. I mean, and we've already saw in chapter 7, I mean, that was an arduous journey that they were making and a very lengthy one. And so for people in their 80s or beyond, there wouldn't have been a lot of them around, but how many of them would have physically been able to have made that journey back to Israel? There wouldn't have been that many. Now we've had a number of years that have passed since then. I mean, how many of these ones that are going back with Ezra the priest have any memory of being in the land of Israel? There's a pretty good chance that there were none left at this point that would have remembered the land of Israel, that had any memory of it if they'd ever been there at all. So, if any, it would have been a very scant number. So for the most part, all these ones that he, not just the most part, probably for the entire part, these ones here in chapter 8 that he's telling us about that went back, they're not going back to some home they left and remembered, and now they get a chance to go back to where they came from, where they have memories of it and all of that. I mean, for them, they're leaving the only place they've ever known. I mean, they grew up in Babylon, and that's where their home was. That's where they've spent their whole lives. They're leaving that behind to go to a land that they're utterly unfamiliar with, that they've never been before, but they're doing that for what reason? That's where they needed to be to serve God. So these are people that have their spiritual priorities right, that their reason for the decisions they're making is to do what is best in the sight of God, not what is easiest for them or what their personal preferences are. They are first and foremost looking at what God's will is and then making their decisions, a big life decision based on that, we can see when God is giving us the details of the ones who did that. He's certainly giving honor to the ones who did that, but then by doing so, what's he also encouraging us to do? That's a lesson here, as it was in chapter 2, so we have it again. So this is a second opportunity for us to get that point. And I mean, what should be, we all have decisions we make in life. Some are bigger than others. They're all important, every decision we make, because God is presenting us with an opportunity in what we decide. Well, even in the least of the things, in the smallest decisions we make, what is the basis of those decisions? What are we considering, or what should we? Yeah, that is the issue that we should be thinking about. I mean, in the smallest of matters and in the greatest of matters. What are the biggest decisions that we make in life? What would we think is the number one most important decision that we make in our lives that we spend here on this earth? Well, number one is the original decision of whether we're going to believe in God and obey Him, seek Him and serve Him. I mean, that's number one. Because if we don't make that decision, then none of these other life decisions are going to be, we don't even have the basis to begin with to make the right decisions or anything else. So, and that's why that's the first and greatest commandment, isn't it? For us to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. So for us, choosing to serve Christ, I mean, that is the number one biggest decision, whether we're going to do that or not. I mean, so after that, because we're really talking now about those who've made that decision, then what are the big decisions, the biggest decisions we make in life from that point? Yeah, I mean, those really are who we marry. That's who we're going to be spending our life with, the rest of our life with on this earth. That's also very likely going to be a decision about who is going to be the other parent of our children and the generations that come, and all the influences that are going to be upon them for that. It would be hard to find a bigger or more important decision in our lives than who we're going to marry, where we live. I mean, that's a huge one. Did that have any impact on Lot when he chose to live there in Sodom and Gomorrah? Abraham gave his nephew first choice about where to live. Abraham chose to live there on the plains. Was that strictly an agricultural decision? Because they had flocks. I mean, they had to separate because staying together, their flocks had become too great a number to share the same land. But were there enough places on the plains in the land of Canaan where they both could have lived? Could Lot have chosen an area outside of those wicked cities to live? Would have been separate from Abraham, but not in those wicked places? The answer is yes. But Abraham's decision of where he was going to live was, like with everything else, it was what was going to be best for him to serve God. There's a reason Abraham is called the friend of God. Now, Lot did serve the Lord, and he was vexed with the wickedness of those places where he lived, and we're told that in 2 Peter 2 about how daily he was vexed by all of those ungodly deeds that were done there. So he didn't change himself as far as what he believed and what he was doing, and he didn't come to the point of participating in that those wicked things. What about his children? They were. And so that was a decision that greatly impacted them. He lost his wife also. She looked back and was turned into a pillar of salt. But why did she look back? Why are we told to remember Lot's wife in Luke 17? That's right. And What have we been called out of? I mean, the word church means, the word ecclesia means what? Ek, out. The other part comes from kaleo, which our English word call. The called out ones, that's what the word church means. What have we been called out of? Now, if we choose to follow Christ and come out of this world, which as we are commanded to do, and if we're thinking, oh, I sure do miss all those great parties I used to go to and all those things, and we're thinking back fondly of all those wild things or whatever it was that we were doing when we weren't followers of Christ and all those things we participated in, and we're just sighing over not being able to do that anymore. I mean, is that a problem? Yes, and if we're looking back to that, I mean, can we get brought back into the world? We can. I mean, that's a big part of the warning of the parable of the sower, the thorny ground. So we can be choked with the cares and riches and pleasures of this life. That can happen to a Christian. So that's why we're warned to remember Lot's wife. Did she have a fondness for Sodom and Gomorrah? She obviously did, and she was sorry to be leaving. I mean, how could you be sorry to leave those places? She obviously liked being there. So even though Lot didn't, it cost him his family. So where we live, does it make a difference where we choose to be? It makes a big difference. What we choose to do, I mean, everything from, I mean, the type of job that we choose, the location, and there's so many things like that. I mean, and then every decision we make, we need to think, well, is this going to be best for me, for the Lord? I mean, there's all kinds of things that we could choose. I mean, we may get an opportunity, some kind of a job offer, where we could double our salary, but then we're going to be on the road half the time where we can't be, or even if we're not traveling to do it, where our job obligations are going to keep us away where we can't meet with the church half the time or whatever it is. Would that be a good decision? But that I could make twice as much. What is the basis of our decision? Is it strictly on salary? Is it strictly on, or do we need to think about, well, would it be better if we made less, but if we had our time available where we weren't going to be hindered from being with our brothers and sisters in Christ on the times appointed where we could meet with the church and do God's will, and we could get into a job situation where we are, it puts so much of a demand on our time that we really can't do much of anything as far as our service to the Lord, that our service is for that job that we're getting paid so well for or something. I mean, do those kinds of situations happen where we have decisions like that? Or what should we do? Do we think about the material side of it, or what think of all what we could do with that money or something. I mean, that's really a test. I mean, are we seeking our own things? Are we wrapped up in the world, or do we make our decisions about what God desires for us to do, what's best for our serving Him? I mean, that's what we need to be making all our decisions on. These people did, and he's really singling them out here in Ezra 8 as he did with the ones in Ezra chapter 2. These were people that chose to leave their homes, to leave the only place they had known, to go to for them is now a strange land. I mean, this is very similar to what Abram did in Genesis 12 when God told him to leave his family and his homeland to go to another place, which happened to be the land of Canaan. I mean, they're really doing much the same thing. They do have company, which is good, but still, this was a big decision, and one that they obviously made in terms of what was going to be best for the Lord. And as we read further now, and from verse 15, we also see that for some of these ones, it was brought very specifically to them about the need, the spiritual need for them to make this decision. Before we go further there in chapter 8 with verse 15, but let's do go back to chapter 7 for a moment when he's summarizing here Ezra's return to the land of Israel and the ones who went with him. Back in chapter 7 and verse 7, it says, "And there went up some of the children of Israel and of the priests and the Levites and the singers and the porters and the Nethinims unto Jerusalem in the seventh year of Artaxerxes the king." So these are the ones that went back with Ezra, and it included a number of other Israelites, and also, because he said some of the children of Israel, and then priests, Levites, singers, porters, Nethinims, these different ones, and they had their different jobs to do for the Lord. Now, when we read chapter 7 and verse 7, where he summarizes in one verse all that went back with him, with Ezra, and then we have the breakdown in chapter 8, verses 1 through 14 of these different families that went with him and their numbers, or groups and their numbers, we might not, if we didn't have the details that come up in, for example, in verses 15 through 20, we might think this was all just happened very smoothly, where Ezra decides to go back to Israel, gets the permission that he got with the letter that we read last week from Artaxerxes the king that permitted him to go, and all the ones with him, and all the other details that were in that letter with the financing and everything else that was going to be from the through their journey, and even when they got back, and the fact that they couldn't be taxed, all those things that were in that letter, which was very important. But we might think, well, he just makes the decision to go. Ezra gets the letter from Artaxerxes and then says, "Hey, everybody, let's go back." And then a bunch of them say, "Okay." And then that's that, and it all goes smoothly. Well, there's some more details to the picture that we're given in verses 15 to 20 that let us know how this actually came about, at least with some of them. So let's read these next six verses here in Ezra 8, 15 to 20. He says, "And I gathered them together to the river that runneth to Ahava, and there abode we in tents 3 days. And I viewed the people and the priests, and found there none of the sons of Levi." Now that's a problem. What were the sons of Levi? What was notable or important about the lack of their presence here when he's viewing the people? So Ezra's taking account of all the ones that are gathered there to make the trip back, and there are none of the sons of Levi. Now there are priests there. Well, aren't priests sons of Levi? Well, they are, but they are a distinct group of the sons of Levi, such that the term the sons of Levi are referring to all the other members of the tribe of Levi than the priests. So what was, just to remind ourselves, all priests were Levites, but not all Levites were priests, correct? To be a priest under the law of Moses, one had to be a descendant of whom? Aaron. Not just Levi. Now, Aaron was a descendant of Levi, but to be a priest in Israel, one had to be a male descendant of Aaron, who is the original high priest. So that was just one family of the Levites. So all the other families of the tribe of Levi, anyone that was of the tribe of Levi who was not directly descended from Aaron, they're in this group, the sons of Levi. And in the law of Moses, what did God specify concerning the those children of Levi that were not priests? Did they just, well, since you can't be a priest, therefore you have no importance in God's work? Is that the way it was for them? Or did God have a job? Did he have something reserved as a work for the Lord for the rest of the tribe of Levi that weren't the priests? Well, the answer is yes. If you can keep your mark there in Ezra 8, let's go back to Numbers chapter 3. And we want to read verses 5 through 10. This is just a refresher on this. Actually, if we go back even before that, he's clearly talking about the priests and their office. So he starts Numbers chapter 3 saying, "These are the generations of Aaron and Moses in the day that the Lord spake with Moses in Mount Sinai. And these are the names of the sons of Aaron: Nadab the firstborn and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the priests, which were anointed, whom he consecrated to minister in the priest's office. And Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord when they offered strange fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, and they had no children. And Eleazar and Ithamar ministered in the priest's office in the sight of Aaron their father." So that's one of many passages that very plainly specify who the priests were in Israel. These were the sons of Aaron, and he had four, but the first two were smitten by God for offering strange fire before him. And if you want a reference to where that's recorded originally, that's in Leviticus 10, 1 and 2. They did not have children at the time, so now Aaron's descendants are going to come through one of two sons, Eleazar and Ithamar. And that's the case for all the other the priests that ever served in among the Israelites for the duration of the Old Covenant, until it was really until you get to 70 AD when it was when the nation, the physical nation of Israel, was brought to an end. But from this point where Aaron is made high priest, all of the priests descended from Aaron through Eleazar or Ithamar. Those were the only ones who were authorized by God to be priests. We're even told in Hebrews 7, 13 and 14, that's the reason that Jesus Christ was not a priest when he was on this earth. He was not a priest because he was of the tribe of Judah, of which tribe it says Moses spake nothing concerning priesthood. And that is God, through Moses, spoke nothing about being a priest. So where does he mention here about anybody from the tribe of Judah being able to be a priest? He doesn't. So does that mean that somebody from Judah could say, well, you didn't say that I couldn't be a priest, therefore I can be a priest? Actually, some people tried that argument, didn't they? More than once. In number 16, Korah, who was a Levite but not a descendant of Aaron, he chafed at the fact that he couldn't be a priest. And he was arguing, well, you took this on yourselves, and there's no reason the rest of us in Levi can't be priests too. And so he made a rebellion. God made the earth open up and swallow up Korah and all of his company that joined in that rebellion. And then it was in number 17 where God got all the tribes of Israel to make a rod and put the name of the tribe on it, and then for Levi, it didn't just say Levi, it had Aaron's name. The point being, who is God authorizing to be priests in Israel? And what happened with the rods of all the other tribes? Nothing. What did he do with the tribe, with the rod that had Aaron's name on it? He made it bud and it bore almonds. And that was placed in the Ark of the Covenant, one of only three objects that were placed within the Ark of the Covenant. What were the other two? Yes, the tables of stone that the second copy that Moses came down from Mount Sinai with, and then that pot of the manna. So was that an important event in number 17 when God made that rod that had Aaron's name on it bud and bear almonds? That was God made a miracle there to show that he authorized Aaron's sons and only Aaron's sons to be priests. But as we read those first four verses in Numbers chapter 3, that's very clear who the priests were. These were Aaron's sons. So then verses 5 through 10 here in Numbers chapter 3 says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Bring the tribe of Levi near, and present them before Aaron the priest, that they may minister unto him. And they shall keep his charge and the charge of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of the congregation to do the service of the tabernacle. And they shall keep all the instruments of the tabernacle of the congregation and the charge of the children of Israel to do the service of the tabernacle. And thou shalt give the Levites unto Aaron and to his sons. They are wholly given unto him out of the children of Israel. And thou shalt appoint Aaron and his sons, and they shall wait on their priest's office, and the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death." So anyone that God hadn't authorized would be put to death. So he very plainly states that Aaron's sons were the ones authorized to be priests, but all the others of the tribe of Levi were reserved to assist the priests in the service of the tabernacle. Well, then later that became the temple. And now that the temple has been rebuilt, that is the case. So what did they need? There were priests going back, but what if you have priests that go back and there aren't any Levites? I mean, the some had gone back with Zerubbabel, so it wasn't like there weren't any in the land of Israel. But if you're having more priests to go back, do you need more Levites? Do they need more people to be able to assist the priests in, because you're going to have a lot more Israelites coming to Jerusalem for the feast days. You don't want that to turn into one of those Walmart situations where you have like 20 of those checkout lines and there's only one person that's working, and then everybody's got to get in that one line. I mean, that doesn't work out too well, does it? But anyway, they needed more Levites to be back in the land to help the priests in the work they were doing. So Ezra's taking account of all the people. So they're getting ready to start the journey. They spend 3 days there. Ezra is taking account of everybody who's there, and he recognizes there aren't any Levites to go back with these priests. So what does he do? So back to Ezra chapter 8. After it says he found there none of the sons of Levi, verse 16 says, "Then sent I for Eliezer, for Ariel, for Shemaiah, and for Elnathan, and for Jerubin, and for Elnathan, and for Nathan, and for Zechariah, and for Meshulam, chief men, also for Joarib, and for Elnathan, men of understanding. And I sent them with commandment unto Iddo, the chief, at the place Casiphia." And that's a place name there in Babylon. So that's just a place where Iddo was. And he says, "And I told them what they should say unto Iddo and to his brethren, the Nethinims, at the place Casiphia, that they should bring unto us ministers for the house of our God. And by the good hand of our God upon us, they brought us a man of understanding of the sons of Mahili, the son of Levi, the son of Israel, and Sherebiah with his sons and his brethren, 18, and Hashabiah, and with him Jehiah of the sons of Merari, his brethren and their sons, 20. Also of the Nethinims, whom David and the princes had appointed for the service of the Levites, 220 Nethinims, all of them were expressed by name." So that's another group that we read about, these Nethinims, and they were ones that were given jobs, and this goes back to the time of David when this group was appointed to help the Levites. So the Levites were to help the priests. Now you have a certain group that had the job to assist the Levites themselves. And so these were all needed people for the works, directly for the work of the Lord, with the temple. So there, and it says that plainly, that they were ministers for the house of our God, as it says at the end of verse 17. So there weren't any of these originally there ready to make the journey back. So Ezra sends out a call that they need Levites and Nethinims to make this journey. And so here you have a number of them, one group of 18 and another group of 20 of the sons of Levi, and then these 220 Nethinims. So now here's a lot more that join to make the trip back. So they end up going. They make the decision to go. They weren't there in the originally, but now when the need is presented to them, we need people to go back to fulfill this God-given role for the house of God, for the temple that's now been rebuilt. And you have quite a number that respond to that and they say, okay, we will go and do that. So this is good. I mean, we can see that their priority was and their decision was to do that work. When they're told this is a work of God and you're needed for that work. Now, leave your homes, leave all that you've been doing behind. I mean, because they're not going back. Make the decision. You're leaving all this behind forever, and you're going to go there, and this is going to be your new work for the rest of your life. And they say, okay, that's what we're going to do. So that's very good and very encouraging to read about ones who had a heart to do that. So we can see a little more of the details of how this came about. So it didn't happen that everybody all signed up at once to go back. In this case, there were some others that had to be reminded and, hey, we have a need for you. And then they said, okay, they would do this, and they did. And so after that happens, in verse 21, it says, then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava that we might afflict ourselves before our God to seek of him a right way for us and for our little ones and for all our substance. For I was ashamed to require of the king a band of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy in the way, because we had spoken unto the king, saying, the hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek him, but his power and his wrath is against all them that forsake him. So we fasted and besought our God for this, and he was entreated of us. So here they are getting ready to make the journey. What is Ezra... What was he ashamed or embarrassed about? Yeah, to ask for protection, to have some of the Persian soldiers. Artaxerxes was prepared to do that, to have some armed guards to accompany them back, to protect them on the journey. But Ezra has been saying that and... he had been telling Artaxerxes, and they're telling all the Persians that God is their protector, that God is protects his children, whom they are. So if that's what he's talking, and then he says, but now can you give us some soldiers to keep us safe on our journey back? Then how does that line up? Well, that he was seeing a problem with that. He wanted their actions to be consistent with those words. Now, in fact, had God promised his people that if they were serving him, that he would protect them from their enemies? That was a specific promise that was given through Moses. And several times we can read the book of Leviticus, we can read the book of Deuteronomy in particular, and we find that promise repeated multiple times. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 are very lengthy passages. I just mentioned that for your reference to study, because we don't have time to look at those at this moment. But Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28 are among a number of passages, and those two stand out for the length or the details of it, where God made that promise for them, And along with it, of course, he gave the, that was the blessing if they kept his commandments, but then the opposite was God's promise as a curse to not protect them from their enemies, to actually bring their enemies upon them and defeat at their hands if they disobey the Lord and his commandments. Well, these are people that are seeking God, that are committed to serve him and keep his commandment. So do they believe that God is going to keep his promise to protect them from their enemies? Is God able to protect this group of people in that journey from Babylon all the way back to Israel for those hundreds of miles through that all of that territory where there could be many different dangers that could confront them there, and whether it be of a beast or of other people in that in making that trip? I mean, was God capable? Was he able to protect them and deliver them safely on the way? That was a promise he had made to them. So Ezra did not want to have to have Persian soldiers to be responsible for their security on the trip. So he did not want a band of soldiers and horsemen to help us against their enemies on the way. So what do they want? What does he seek to do then? They are fasting, and they are going to be praying to God for his help so that he would protect them. So they're preparing themselves for the journey, but this is a major part of it, that spiritually they're going to be prepared and they're going to be asking God for his protection, so that they're going to say no to having those soldiers and horsemen with them. Now, is that going to be a test of their faith to do that? I mean, that's where it's not just words, and that's the point here, is Ezra doesn't... They've said the words that, yes, this is what we believe God has promised, and he had promised that, but if they really believe that, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to show that they believe that and make the journey and not require these Gentile soldiers to be their protectors. And so that's what they're going to do. So, but he's preparing for that, to have the people to fast and seek of him a right way for them and for their children and for all that they're carrying back there. So they're going to be asking God to help them. So they're doing this in preparation for that request, and so we can see the sincerity there, certainly, of Ezra and his faith and those of the people that were there. Well, we're out of time for right now. Lord willing, we will continue this in our study from chapter 8 next week. We want to go to our Heavenly Father again in prayer as we close.